So much to learn in the book of Joshua. We started this portion of our study just as, well, basically as we were concluding our study last time, Sunday morning. And in Joshua chapter 1, we noted that Joshua is the one appointed by God to lead the children of Israel into the promised land. We were discussing it Sunday morning from the perspective of the premillennial theory that Jesus at his second coming is going to establish some kind of an earthly kingdom, and the Jews are somehow going to be miraculously transported to the land of Palestine, and the promise that God made to Abraham relative to the land then ultimately to be fulfilled. Of course, that's set on the premise that it wasn't fulfilled during the days of Joshua, and we want to see that indeed it was, so we can answer that. But one of the points in answering that argument is that Joshua would lead them in. We talked about the sequence of events that are described by Stephen in Acts chapter 7, how that these things have a place on the timeline, that 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, ever how many years down the pike would disrupt that sequence of events on the timeline. But in Joshua chapter 1, we noted in verse 4 that the land, from the Lebanon to the great river, the river Euphrates, the land of the Hittites, unto the great sea toward the going down of the sun shall be your border. You see that. And then in verse 6, Joshua, of course, to be the one to cause this people, and I think it was noted, David, I don't remember if it was you, someone noted this people. That is, the people of Israel that Joshua was leading to inherit the land which I swear to give unto their fathers. Of course, this condition of observing the law, we've noted that already, and we know what law, as Moses told them in Deuteronomy chapter 30 in verse 10, keep the commandments, statutes, and ordinances contained in this book of the law. We know what that was then. It was the law of Moses that he's referring to. In chapter 2, as we studied further in the book of Joshua, we noted the works of Rahab the harlot and how that the Apostle Paul in James chapter 2, references Rahab the harlot as a character of faith in that she believed God and she believed what God had done and that the children of Israel were indeed going to conquer and take the city of Jericho, and so she hid the spies because she believed God. And of course, we did pause to note that her belief in what God said was based on evidence that she had seen and heard. She had heard of what God did at the crossing of the Red Sea, and she had heard the deliverance of the Amorites into the hand of the Israelites, and she said, "Our hearts did melt." And, of course, she hid these spies and allowed them to escape. Now, in chapter 3 is where we left off, and I ask you to study in particular very carefully chapter 3 and chapter 4 because these two chapters are quite impressive, I believe. They are to me. As in these chapters, Joshua prepares the people to go in and to take the land. And, of course, between the people and the land, there is a big obstacle. What is it? The Jordan River. And we're going to note in verse 15 that the Jordan River is not only swift, as we have studied from Mount Hermon's peaks, about 10,000 feet elevation, porous rock, I understand, where the snow would melt down through the mountain and come up as a spring at the base of the mountain, forming what I understand was the beginning of what later became the Dead Sea at the southern end, but then forming the Sea of Galilee, the Jordan River, flowing down through the Jordan River Valley into the Dead Sea, which is at the surface of the sea, 1,300 about so feet below sea level. Now, if you have water that originates up here at 10,000 feet on top of Mount Hermon, and then begins to trickle down at the bottom of Mount Hermon and then flows to an elevation of 1,300 feet below sea level. And I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, the distance from the Sea of Galilee to the northern tip of the Dead Sea is something in the neighborhood of about 66 miles, if memory serves me correctly. And that is a tremendous drop in elevation. So you've got water that's very swift. But secondly, if you'll note in Joshua chapter 3 in verse 15, the text tells us that it's during the flood season. During the time of harvest, it overflows its banks. So you've got very swift water, plus you have a whole lot of it, very wide during the flood stages. And we mention that because when Joshua is preparing these people to cross the Jordan River, he tells them that the way that you're going, you've never passed this way before, verse 4. You see that? This is going to be an entirely new experience for you. And it's not just simply in being in a place they've not been before, which is true, but how they get there is going to be something quite impressive. And he calls their attention to that in verses 9 and 10. When he said to them, "Come hither and hear the words of Jehovah your God." And Joshua said, "Hereby ye shall know that the living God is among you, and that he will drive out from before you the Canaanite, the Hittite, the Hivite, and the Perizzite, and the Girgashite, and the Amorite, and the Jebusite." Now, I want you to key in on those ites. Every time we read that, the list is essentially the same. We are first introduced to that list in Genesis chapter 15, where God is speaking to Abraham and promising him this land and identifies the peoples who were then living in the land. We're in Joshua chapter 3, talking about the conquest of the land of Canaan. And as we noted here, Joshua said, "You're going to know that God, the living God, is among you, and that he will, without fail, drive out these inhabitants." Now, that was a very much needed lesson because, as you recall, the first time that they came essentially to this point, as they had come up to Kadesh Barnea 38 years before, they did not believe that God could deliver their enemies into their hand. Joshua and Caleb did and made that argument. But the people did not believe, the Hebrew writer tells us in Hebrews chapter 3 and chapter 4, and so consequently God said, "You get to wander for 38 more years, making this period of wandering 40 long years. Now as you drop down into the next few verses of chapter 3, how are they going to get across the Jordan River? Joshua tells them, those of you who are priests, who are carrying the Ark of the Covenant, what's to happen when you step your feet into the water? What will happen to the water? It'll stop flowing. It'll stop flowing. It'll stop flowing at this swift rate from this elevation that we've discussed, and how much water there is, it's going to be stopped. And you will walk across on dry ground. Let's pick up the reading beginning in verse 14. Carolyn, you feel like reading some for me? 14 through 17, please.
"So when the people set out from their tents to cross the Jordan, the priests carried the Ark of the Covenant before the people. And when those who carried the Ark came into the Jordan, and the feet of the priests carrying the Ark were dipped in the edge of the water, so the Jordan overflows all its banks on the days of harvest, the waters which were flowing down from above stood and rose up in one heap, a great distance away at Adam.
That must have been impressive. They just stand there in the middle and the waters wall up over here and they go across. Now, we've talked about how many came up out of the land of Egypt, about 2 to 3 million people. Now, we know there's been some deaths, obviously. All those who were 20 years old and upward have died. And now we have a new generation on the scene that has not seen the mighty works of God in this way. Of course, I'm aware of the provisions of God for them during the period of wandering, But they've not seen anything like this, like their fathers did, who were 19 and younger when they came up out of the land of Egypt. They saw the Red Sea part. But this generation has not seen that. And so they need to know that you can go in and take the land. Our forefathers didn't believe that. But you need to be impressed that you can. And as we continue then into the fourth chapter, they were instructed to take 12 stones from the midst of the river as they were crossing over. And these stones were to be made into a pillar of stones, not only to mark the place, but to be a valuable tool in teaching their children what God did, their children and their children's children. Now that piece of instruction is something that has existed even from the time that they came up out of the land of Egypt and the law was first given. You remember in Deuteronomy chapter 6, beginning in verse 6, you're to teach your children when they get up, when they go to bed, when they go out, when they come in. The Word of God is to be impressed upon their young minds from a state of infancy right on through. And this pillar of stones would provide a tool to teach them the great things that God did. Now, this is not the first of the tools that God has given to these people to teach their children. What was among the first? The Passover, the observance of the Passover. This, too, was to be a yearly feast. So when they observed this feast, their children and their children's children would ask, "What mean ye by this feast?" And they were to teach their children of the night when death came to all of the houses, or to the firstborn of all of the houses of the Egyptians, those who did not have the blood over the door and on the post beside the door as the Israelites did, and death did not occur in those houses. What a valuable lesson to teach these children of what God has done and His great deliverance. The Red Sea, of course, would be another reminder. And now here, the crossing of the Jordan. They took everything. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I haven't heard of it. Very interesting. Yeah. Very interesting. Yeah. Yeah. Well, we know that Abraham was told that they would come out in 400 years with great substance. And then they were told that the Egyptians will give you whatever you ask. And then when they come out, we know that they came out with all the riches of the Egyptians. So, who knows? It is possible, I suppose. No. Not to, no. Richard?
I was just thinking another incidental part of this miracle. In fact, once again, just like with the Red Sea, they crossed over on dry ground.
That's right.
They weren't wading up to their hips in mud.
That's right. That's right. Of course, it was really swift. And you know, the water that parted the Red Sea was, the wind was east and very cold and froze the walls. That's yes, yes, yes. Freezing time. Yeah. Well, I'm being facetious, but yeah, there's all that. But such explanations of miracles are hardly acceptable. But in this text, that's very, very good. But in this text, we do note that they came across on dry ground, and this pillar of stones. Carolyn, you made an interesting observation back, I don't remember how long, and I've used it in lessons that I've taught on this through the years since you told me about, and I don't remember the little girl, that what her name was, which one was in your class. Who?
Riley.
Was it Riley? Okay, that makes sense. But Carolyn and I were talking about this, that in verse 19 through verse 24 of Joshua chapter 4, we read that the people came up out of the Jordan on the 10th day of the first month and encamped in Gilgal on the east border of Jericho. And those 12 stones which they took out of the Jordan did Joshua set up in Gilgal. And he spake unto the children of Israel, saying, when your children shall ask their fathers in time to come, saying, what mean these stones? Then ye shall let your children know, saying, Israel came over this Jordan on dry land. For Jehovah your God dried up the waters of the Jordan from before you until ye were passed over, as Jehovah your God did to the Red Sea, which he dried up from before us until we were passed over, that all the peoples of the earth may know the hand of Jehovah, that it is mighty, that ye may fear Jehovah your God forever. Two or three things in this, but I want to first finish what I said, or started to say about Carolyn's class. As I recall, you brought 12 stones from the driveway and used them to teach this lesson of how they made a stack of these stones. And Riley was gone that day, yeah. And she came in the next class period, I guess, and saw those gravel on the corner of the table, and guess what she asked? What mean these stones? Yeah. And so the application of that is phenomenal. Yeah. It's impressive. It's very impressive. Because God knows that little ones ask questions. Little ones see things and they're curious and they ask questions. And what better lesson to drive home here than to put this pillar of stones in a well-traveled travelway or roadway where children would no doubt be traveling with parents or grandparents and would ask this question. They'd see that. What does it mean? And all of us have had experiences, I'm sure, with monuments. I recall one when I was quite small, the Jefferson Davis Monument in Kentucky, and I've forgotten now, Fairview, Kentucky, I forget, where it is. Juan, you could find that for me right quick if you don't mind. Where the Jefferson Davis Monument is located in Kentucky. I don't want to give out wrong information, but that's the memorial for Jefferson Davis, who was the first and only president of the Confederate States of America. And when I saw that, to me, it was just a huge, huge structure built out of concrete. I could tell you some of the history of it if you'd like, but it's over 300 and some odd feet tall, 361, I think, feet tall. But it's there for the purpose of memory of who this man was. And as a little boy, all I was impressed with was, man, that's huge. I want to go up in that, which I did, and had to look out the little windows and so forth. And this was pretty neat. But the significance of it, I really wasn't taught as a little boy. Now, I think sometimes there are occasions for us to teach little ones about some great and mighty things. And they're impressed with the great and mighty thing, but somehow the significance of it, the lesson, is lost. Now, these fathers and grandfathers who would travel with their children through this part of the country, traveling on the way through Gilgal, and the little one says, what meaneth these stones? And you say, oh, that's where we came into the promised land. Well, now, academically, as Terry says, that's correct. That's where they crossed over. And it serves as a marker of the place, but that's not teaching the valuable lesson. Look at the lesson that was to be taught. He says in verse 23, "For Jehovah your God dried up the waters of the Jordan from before you until ye were passed over, as Jehovah your God did to the Red Sea, which dried up from before us until we were passed over." Hold your finger right there. Because these now who are fathers and grandfathers, they saw what God did to the Red Sea. But this generation didn't see that. These are those who were born in the wilderness. They didn't see that. But now the Jordan is dried up before you. Now look, if you will, at the cause or at the effect that's produced, to produce. Verse 24. "That all the peoples of the earth may know the hand of Jehovah, that it is mighty, that ye may fear Jehovah your God forever." Two purposes of that. Number one, the effect that that will have upon everybody. But then number two, the effect that that ought to have upon you, lest you forget who God is. Do we see that? What a remarkable lesson. When they would pass this way, and keeping in mind the size of this land, it's not all that huge. And the likelihood of in your lifetime passing this way several times and seeing this, and what an impression it should make the first time you hear the story, and then the second time, and the third time, and then as you grow and continue to see it and grow up in this environment, the idea then is that's where you take your children to show them the great things that God has done. And so chapter 3 and chapter 4 of the book of Joshua are quite impressive. And I want you to be very impressed with that. Now I've already gone through many of these slides in our discussion. But mark that place, Gilgal. Gilgal is where this monument was erected as a valuable tool to teach this lesson. Any questions or comments just here? Yes, Joey? It is indeed. It is indeed. And how many of us who are adults have had our children or grandchildren say, "Papa, what are we doing? What does this mean?" Children are curious. And when we're doing something and doing it with some regularity, there's a reason behind that. And we don't need to answer that question by saying this is just something God wants us to do, because we've just minimized and dug underneath the real... we've downplayed the whole thing. That's right. That's right. So we need to remember. All right? When... Yes, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Oh, yeah, it would. Sure would. This is the Jabbok River up here. Yeah. Isn't that something? It did indeed. And it would have to be for that many people to cross on dry ground. Very good. You know, some of those, what I'll call incidentals, they're really not, but for lack of a better term, the study using the maps really makes that impressive, doesn't it? To see how much water we're talking about, how far away it was, had to be, in order for them to do what God has instructed them to do. Well, we come to the conquering of the city of Jericho, and of course you see why. It's the first one coming up out of this gulch of the Jordan River Valley. The city of Jericho has to be taken. And the city of Jericho was not a small place. It was a good-sized city. And we've already talked about in our last study the necessity of these walls around these city-states, much different from what existed down in Egypt. And Jericho is to be given to the Israelites. Yes. You can. Richard was showing on a particular map. What map was it you had there in your book?
The one on page 45 doesn't show Adam, but I looked it up on the maps in my Bible and showed it is at the confluence of the Jabbok and Jordan River.
No, I have a hard time wrapping my mind around that too. Where did it go? Of course, we've got the Jordan River Valley, which we've already talked about the elevation on both sides of that. We've got a plummet down into the bottom of the valley, so it would back up and hold a lot of water before it overflowed the mountains. That's interesting fact, too. All right, very good. Very good. So Israel has to conquer Jericho as they go through. And in chapter 6, I want to call your attention to this chapter. In verse 1, it says, "Now Jericho was straitly shut up because of the children of Israel. None went out, none came in." And we've talked about, I don't remember if it was this class, covering some of this same material in three classes, and it's hard for me to remember who I talked with what about. But the city of Jericho being straightly shut up, that's interesting. One of the advantages of a walled city was you could supposedly keep the enemy out there. But if the enemy was a lot larger than you were and had more supplies than you did, being straightly shut up inside the walls could be a big disadvantage because you could run out of supplies, which we see evidence of that occurring in certain instances, the destruction of the city of Jerusalem being one, where people became so hungry that they became cannibals, eating their own children, as we see in one particular instance. And I'm sure that's not unique, but be that as it may, that was the condition of the city of Jericho being straightly shut up. None went out, none came in. The Israelites are encamped around them. Where are you going to go? You close the gates and you hunker down because you're there for a while. And what we note here is God said in verse 2, "See, I have given into thy hand Jericho and the king thereof and the mighty men of valor. I have given it to you." But now wait just a minute, get the picture there. Israel is encamped outside the city, and Jericho is a walled city, and the inhabitants there are walled up inside the city. They're not yet rooted out, are they? But God said, "I have given you the city." It's theirs, but then God tells them the conditions that they must meet in order to take the city. Now, that's a simple illustration that simply because God has given something does not necessitate the conclusion that it's unconditional. God gave them the city, the king, and the mighty men. But then the conditions were they were to march around the city once each day for 6 days, and on the seventh day march around 7 times, and then they were to blow on the ram's horns, and the priest were to shout. And then the people were to shout, and then the walls were to fall down, and every man would go up straight before him. Again, I want to call your attention to verse 20. In verse 20, it says, "So the people shouted, and the priests blew the trumpets, and it came to pass, when the people heard the sound of the trumpet, that the people shouted with a great shout, and the wall fell down flat, So that the people went up unto the, or into the city, every man straight before him, and they took the city. Now, the fact that they were to go up, each man straight before him, you see that in verse 5, and you see it fulfilled now in verse 20. Means they didn't have to hunt for a hole in the wall. They didn't have to keep marching until they found a gate that was dilapidated that they could kind of push open. The walls fell down flat everywhere, so that every man went up straight before him. Now, some have tried to describe that the walls and the ancient ruins and so forth, it appears as if there was a blast. That's all beside the point. God made it fall. The text tells us that all the walls fell, and every man went up straight before him. Archaeologists have found that all the walls are down. So they went up every man straight before him and took the city. Now we would think at this point everything's wonderful, right? Not hardly. Let's keep reading, and then we'll come back and pick up some more information. In verse 26, it says, "And Joshua charged them with an oath at that time, saying, Cursed be the man before Jehovah that riseth up and buildeth this city, Jericho. With the loss of his firstborn shall he lay the foundation thereof, and with the loss of his youngest son shall he set up the gates of it. So Jehovah was with Joshua, and his fame was in all the land." Now, who wants to volunteer as the mathematician in the family? Joey, thank you. Oh, all right, Chris, I'm going to pick on you, mathematician in the family. All right. A curse is pronounced here. This city is not to be rebuilt. The man who rebuilds the city will lose his oldest child, oldest son. When he concludes the rebuilding of the city, he will lose his youngest son. Now, time passes. It just passes and passes, and we think that this is all lost history. Turn over for me, if you will, Randy, to 1 Kings chapter 16. 1 Kings chapter 16. And in 1 Kings chapter 16, let's read, beginning at verse... let's do verse 30. Well, wait, I'm in the wrong chapter. Let's read verse 33 and 34. Yes, please. All right, we see obviously the statement is very clear that this curse that was pronounced by Joshua is fulfilled with the efforts of this Bethlehemite, Hiel. Now, what I want Chris to work on for me, if he will, and you may need to help me some with this, if you don't mind, but I want to see about how long it took for this prophecy to come to pass, because during the time of the judges, how long was that period? That's after, of course, Joshua, but the period of the judges. How long was it? Pardon me? At least, if memory serves me, it was about 300, 305 years, the period of the judges. And the last of the judges was Samuel. And during the reign of Samuel as judge or deliverer, they asked for a king, and the first king was Saul, and he reigned 40 years, and then David, and he reigned 40 years, and then Solomon, and he reigned 40 years, and then his son Rehoboam, and I'm not sure exactly how long Rehoboam reigned as king, but if you count from Rehoboam up to Ahab, that's where I need some help. How many kings were there, or approximately how many years from Rehoboam to Ahab? Yeah, I do. but I don't have it up there. I had to look for it. Chris got it here in the book. It's right in the middle of your book, The Chart of the Kings. The Chart of the Kings. See, that's where we put our mind in gear. Pull that up, because I don't have my lesson book with me. But let me do just a little bit of abbreviated math. If you've got 300 years for the period of the judges, and you've got a combined total of 120 years for the United Kingdom, and then you add to that whatever portion might be from Rehoboam to Ahab, about how many years are we talking about generally? 300 plus 120, that's 420 years. So I'm going to guess that we're getting up in the neighborhood of about 500 years. That'd be close. From the time that Jericho was destroyed till the time that Hiel attempted to rebuild it. And he lost his oldest son when he put down the foundation and lost his youngest son when he finally hung the gates. Just like Joshua said. Now what does that tell us about the promise of God? Time don't change anything. Doesn't change a thing. Okay? Is that close? Thereabouts? That was real helpful, wasn't it? Okay, it gives us an idea. But what I want you to see in this is that the conquering of the city of Jericho was total, for one thing, but any kind of reconstruction was not to take place. Now, when you get into the seventh chapter, the next city, as you obviously can see on the map, is the city of Ai. Ai was something in the neighborhood of about 15 or so miles from Jericho, and it had to be destroyed in order for them to move on. And when they came to the city of Ai, someone, I believe, pointed out last time that the city of Ai wasn't as powerful as the city of Jericho, and so it wasn't necessary to send in the whole army. So how many did they send in? 3,000. They sent in 3,000. And what happened when the Israelite army went up against that city? They were defeated. Now, we might not think that if you have an army of 3,000 people and you lose 36 men, that that's a substantial defeat. But it's substantial enough for them to know that God is not helping them. And so they retreat. They're driven away by the army of the city of Ai. Now, pick up the reading at verse 6. You talk about being devastated. It says, "And Joshua rent his clothes and fell to the earth upon his face before the ark of Jehovah until the evening, he and the elders of Israel. And they put dust upon their heads. And Joshua said, Alas, O Lord Jehovah, wherefore hast thou at all brought this people over the Jordan to deliver us into the hand of the Amorites and to cause us to perish? Would that we had been content and dwelt beyond the Jordan? O Lord, what shall I say after that Israel hath turned their backs before their enemies? For the Canaanites and all the inhabitants of the land will hear of it and will compass us around and cut off our name from the earth. And what wilt thou do for thy great name?" Joshua sees a problem. We're your people, and we've been driven out like we're nobody. Now, the people who inhabit the land, they're going to believe that we're nobody. But what are they going to think about your name? Joshua has a grave concern. And what's the response of the Lord? There's sin in the camp. Somebody's done something they ought not to have done. Now, we talked in our last study, I believe, about how that the spoils of the city of Jericho were to be considered the first fruits of the promised land. Did we talk about that in this class? Or did we talk about that a long time ago? I don't remember. Did I talk about that Tuesday? Maybe it was Thursday. I don't remember. But at any rate, the spoils of this city was to be placed into the treasury of the Lord. You'll note in verse 18 of chapter 6, it says, "But as for you, only keep yourselves from the devoted thing." Now, not every translation uses that word. What word is used in some that you're reading from? Pardon me?
Under the ban?
B-A-N. B-A-N. Oh, okay. I hadn't read that. Accursed things, okay? The point being, these things were not theirs, and they were to be placed into the treasury of the Lord. But somebody has taken of the spoils of the city of Jericho, and God said, until that's corrected and the sin is removed, I'll not be with you anymore. And so how do we find out who did it? Joshua calls them in, tribe by tribe, family by family, and then ultimately man by man. And a point I like to point out just here is, suppose you were that man and you see this process of elimination coming. Don't you think that you would be scared to death to know that my turn is coming up pretty soon here, and what am I going to say? Well, Joshua calls Achan, and he tells Achan in verse 19, my son, give, I pray thee, glory to Jehovah, the God of Israel, and make confession unto him, and tell me now what thou hast done, hide it not from me. And Achan begins to just spell out what he did. He said, I saw among the spoil a goodly Babylonian mantle, and 200 shekels of silver, and a wedge of gold of 50 shekels weight, and then I coveted them, and took them, and behold, they are hid in the earth in the midst of my tent, and the silver under it. This is a progressive thing with Achan. Look, if you will, first of all, he said, I saw among the spoil. What did he see? A goodly Babylonian mantle, a beautiful piece of cloth that perhaps a military officer or so forth might wear. And then he saw silver, 200 shekels of silver. I don't know how much that would be. I've thought about calculating that in today's money and see just about how much that would be. But about the time I think about doing that, the value of our dollar changes, and so I don't know how much 200 shekels of silver would be. But you can figure that out and work on that. Or 50 shekels weight of gold and see how much that was. Do the math on that. But I'll dare say that Achan considered himself quite rich when he put the Babylonian garment about his shoulders and handled the silver and the gold, but he could only feel rich in the privacy of his tent. Because if he goes outside or if he tells anybody about it, then everybody will know what Achan did. And now look at the consequences. We've got people that are dead because of what Achan did. We've got women who mourn the loss of their husbands over here in the battle at Ai. Families that suffered the loss of their sons in the battle at Ai. And Achan hearing all of this and knowing that he did this. So, the only good feeling he can have about it, he has to keep to himself. But if you look at verse 22, it says, so Joshua sent messengers, and they ran into the tent. And behold, it was hid in his tent, and the silver under it. And they took them from the midst of the tent, and brought them unto Joshua, and unto all the children of Israel, and they laid them down before Jehovah. And Joshua and all Israel with him took Achan, the son of Zerah, and the silver, now look carefully, and the mantle, and the wedge of gold, and his sons, and his daughters, and his oxen, and his asses, and his sheep, and his tent, and all that he had. And they brought them up into the valley of Achor, and Joshua said, why hast thou troubled us? Jehovah will trouble thee this day. And all Israel stoned him with stones, and they burned them with fire, and stoned them with stones, and they raised over him a great heap of stones unto this day. And Jehovah turned from the fierceness of his anger, wherefore the name of that place was called the Valley of Achor unto this day. Look carefully at that. Achan, how much value does the Babylonian mantle and the gold and the silver have now? As you hear Joshua pronounce condemnation upon you and your family and everything that you own, all of it's to be killed and destroyed. How much value now to these items that were to be cast into the treasury of the Lord? I dare say precious little. Okay?
Seems like
Would seem so, wouldn't it? You know, sometimes, David, consequences extend beyond just the man who's guilty and his family. Suffered right along with him. He lost everything. They were killed. And it was the judgment of God. And it was not wrong for God to pronounce that judgment. Israel needed to see that God meant what He said. Consequences. Let me illustrate. You know, the wrong that is done may be done by somebody that you don't even know. But you suffer just the same. For example, suppose there's a drunk driver driving down the freeway and he crosses over the median and he meets you head on. Well, let's suppose that it's you and it's Judy and you've got a car full of kids. And all are either killed or injured severely. Well, you don't even know that man's name. You didn't hold him down and pour the liquor in him. But because of the judgment that he made, you're over here suffering. Now, I don't know to what extent Achan's family may have known about the wrong that he did. They may not have known anything. I don't know. Well, no. But here was a judgment that God pronounced. You see. And this was to implement respect and honor for what God had said. We could speculate. Yeah. We could speculate and say, well, maybe Achan's family saw him with that Babylonian mantle. Maybe they saw him playing with the money and knew what he did and didn't tell anybody. So that made them party to it. I don't know. All I know is that God said, kill them all. Destroy everything. Even his animals. Destroy everything. Now, to the extent that they were destroyed, look at that. They were stoned with stones. They were burned with fire, and they stoned them some more till they heaped up stones over them. They made a monument out of this place. And this place was called the Valley of Achor. That's a very interesting term. It's used in the Old Testament in the book of Hosea in chapter 2 and verse 15. Hosea chapter 2, verse 15, indicating that the nation of Israel at that point in their history was to be brought down to the Valley of Achor, and it's described as a door of hope. I would just put that in your mind, and you write that passage down and go back and look at that context and see how in the world such a place could be a door of hope to anybody. Okay, Randy? Okay. No. That's right. That's right. But at God's command. Now, one of the interesting things about that is, you remember all the blessings and the curses? God had promised them, I'll bless you in everything you put your hand into, if you do what I say. And here they're going against this city, and they've not done what God said. Now, one of the things that we're going to look at as our studies continue is that, as David has pointed out, consequences to sin is not always restricted to the one who sinned. Case in point, when they were taken into captivity, when Judah was taken into captivity by the Babylonians, we know that the prophet Ezekiel was taken. Ezekiel was one of the good guys, but he had to go into captivity too. And when we talk about city of Jerusalem being destroyed, we know that Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they too were taken captive. But they were among the good guys. But they lost their home too.